freaking auto!
This is Brock and Salk.
Brock Huard is my hero.
What Brock Huard says?
No, he's not a friend.
Subscribe to receive every episode at Apple Podcasts or on Google Podcasts.
We stink, man.
Now, here are your hosts, Brock Huard and Mike Salk.
No way!
Well, here we go, another Brock and Salk podcast. Brock, hello.
Hello, Michael.
Hello.
Hello, Kyle. Hello, Earth.
Hello, world.
Howdy will be joining us one day. Not here yet. Apparently, getting to work on time is too hard for Howdy. So he's not here yet, but he'll come join us. I know it's a podcast. You can feel like we can't just tape whenever we want. I mean, we have
schedule. All day,
right? We have schedules to keep. We have other things we've got to do. So we're just going on ahead without Howdy. He'll be here whenever he gets.
Oh, he'll walk cocksure in there any moment. You know, just shoulders back, arms,
head nodding.
Yes. Yep.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yep. Mm-hmm.
Yep. Just how I wanted this. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Kind of a ton to get to today. We got to everything from football, baseball, a little more hockey today. I got a couple stories for you, Brock. After being at my parents' house for a couple of days, that always leads to some fun and entertainment. I sent you the little video of my dad out there playing softball. So we got a lot to dig into. But I actually wanted to start with something you sent over last night as we were emailing, because I really like this question. Minicamp starts this week. Jamal Adams not likely to be there. What was this initial report that it's a family thing? Is that what we're hearing?
Well, yeah.
His family wants to be taken care of in case he blows out his knee. And
the initial report
is contract first, right?
Tuesday morning, Adam Schefter saying he will not be participating at minicamp.
Ah, but no, he'll be there.
Well, it didn't really clarify.
Okay.
And then Jeremy Fowler followed up shortly after that, again Tuesday morning, and said that the Seahawks are aware he may be dealing with a family issue.
Right. Again, the issue being his family wants to have generational money and doesn't want to get hurt before he signs that deal.
Well, that would be one issue potentially on the table.
That'd be my issue if I were his family. Right.
A potential family / personal issue with Adams that might be a factor. I like how Jeremy puts the /
right.
Yeah, the Seahawks are aware of a potential family / personal issue.
Yeah, I want to get paid. Adams
that might be a factor here.
That you traded half your draft picks for the next few years for me. I kind of want to get paid in order to pay that whole thing off. So yeah, I'm not necessarily surprised that that's how that's going down. We'll talk some more about him in a moment. But you asked a good question, Brock, which is, what are the couple of headlines or stories that you want to be hearing after your first few days here of mandatory camp? You have three. I created three of my own to be prepared to match you headline for headline here.
Oh,
so.
Well done.
Yeah.
Well done.
So you want to go back and forth if
sure.
you want. Okay.
Okay.
So give me the one thing, one headline you want coming out of minicamp.
This Hawks defensive line is dominating camp. New offensive system, Shane Waldron tempo, was listening to Russell talk about how complex it is, was listening to Jake Heaps talk about how efficient they've been and how much the tempo is already better than it's ever been. I hope once all the boys are in, Kerry Hyder's in, Carlos Dunlap is in, the rest of the guys, Al Woods is in, the rest of the crew up front all comes in, that it is, sheesh, the Seahawks defensive line's pretty suffocating.
Mm.
To me, that portends the most amount of success outside of takeaways and the turnover margin. I don't know if there is a better stat in today's football that when your four beat the opponent's five. I've said this now for 12 years to you, Mike, and to everybody that listens to our show and now this podcast. To me, that is the most basic math that just about trumps everything else on a football field.
Well, so. I'm with you. And how did the Bucs just win the Super Bowl? Right?
I mean, Tom Brady.
Yeah, no.
Oh.
It was not, I mean, that didn't hurt, but I don't know if that was the reason, right? I mean, 4-5.
How did the 49ers get there the year before?
Right.
How did the Buccaneers win it? How did the Ravens win it? How did the Seahawks win it? How did the Broncos win it with a broken neck Peyton Manning? You know, how did Carolina Panthers get
broken
there?
Broken Peyton Manning.
Broken.
Either way,
it's a
fine.
Fused neck and a broken Peyton Manning.
So that 4-5,
right.
and you know, there was a commitment and investment to it this offseason. That Kerry Hyder move, I think, is a pretty significant one. Getting Dunlap back is a pretty significant one. Getting Al Woods to return is a pretty significant one. So that's kind of my biggest hope as well. The Seahawks D-line looks like they're supposed to look and is imposing their will throughout camp.
Yeah, I think that would be fantastic. I would love to hear that. Of course, it comes with a caveat, right? Which is, if the Hawks defensive line is dominating for 3 days of camp, it means the offensive line is getting dominated. So, yes. You know, it's one of those things where it's a little careful what you wish
for. Russ wants to stop getting beat up.
He's mentioned that. Right. So
I don't want to see
it. Now, it's
like
also
that.
Entirely possible that it's just the offensive line being like, oh, you want to talk trash about us in the offseason? Why, go on through. Right? Like, you know, that's, I know most of, most of the audience won't get this, but maybe, Brock, you remember in Wildcats when she puts Finch out there on the offensive line and he's like, oh, don't worry about me. You guys can just go. I'm just here. Like, and he's just letting people run by him, and Peanut has to like go hit him in the butt and knock him over on top of the guy. So like, yeah, all right, I'm with you. I'd like to see the DL dominate, but also, you know,
how much of Wildcats did we get through when we tried to watch it with Lydia and Howdy and Kyle, like, the old show team?
Did we even get through the marathon scene?
No,
did you see her run the marathon?
No.
You owe me a new stopwatch. No?
Black and white movies have a hard time keeping
attention. All right. Like,
where's Charlie Chaplin?
No, I think it was a little bit more about the political. I think it was a little more about the political incorrectness, if I remember, as we sat and tried to watch that. Like,
I don't think it was that. No.
I don't remember that. Ooh, I don't remember that.
I just watched it fairly recently. It's a great movie, man. Yeah. One of the all-timers. All right, number one for me, headline I want to hear, Brock.
All-timers.
It's one of my all-timers. Maybe it's not yours, but it's one of mine.
It's
one of my
the
favorite
sport
movies.
Of kings. Yeah. Better than diamond rings. Number one.
Number one headline I want to, because I don't think you're going to get too much on the field, because minicamp. So I'm going to go with number one. Russ and Pete have candlelight dinner together nightly under the stars.
Oh. Beautiful.
Up at Ascend.
Yes.
They're up at Ascend.
They head up to Ascend, right? Get up to the top floor there. Look out over the city of Bellevue and Seattle and Lake Washington. Candlelight, romantic. Like, Russ and Pete got to get back on this. Like, they got to make sure this thing is truly fixed, because it's not just about what they do this year. It's about, you know, the long term of this. Pete and John got their deals, right? Is there a long-term future for Pete, John, and Russ all together here with the Seahawks? And
do you think it's just the two of them and a little marital counseling, or do you think there's a third party kind of involved to continue to broker the relationship? You think Russ brings Jake and Pete brings John? A little flavor, a little fun?
No.
You know,
I don't think so. I can tell you Mark Rogers is not there. That's for sure.
Not invited.
Right. That's like... It's like bringing an ex to a romantic dinner, right? Like, oh, I'm going to have a really romantic dinner with my wife. But I'd also really like to bring my crazy ex-girlfriend.
But don't you want to hear from her?
Who always throws grenades into whatever fire you have going. No, I think that I want to hear about, and you know, I don't know how much words or headlines are going to make this stuff true, but I want to hear that Russ and Pete are getting along and that this whole thing is behind them, right?
I think those two are fine. Russ and Mr. Schneider, Russ and...
But they don't have to be fine.
Front office?
John and Russ don't have to be fine.
You sure?
Yeah, they don't have to.
I mean, in this day and age, Deshaun and Houston kind of didn't start with Bill O'Brien and Aaron.
But Bill O'Brien was everything. Bill O'Brien was a GM and he had too much power and all that. Like, John and Russ, obviously things would be better if they're simpatico. But like, is that mandatory for this thing to work? Not the way it is with Pete and John or Pete and Russ.
Right. Yeah, I think the priority is Pete and Russ, and I do think that that's fine. I think Pete has dealt with so much here over the course of his entire lifetime at 70 that if there is a tremendous trait that he has of handling some of this conflict and chaos, how many times do we talk about that over and over and over again with Marshawn and then Richard? How does he do this? How does he continue to? So I think he's got a lot of scar tissue, and I don't think this one hurt all that bad. I think there's a little bit more sensitivity, kind of like Aaron Rodgers with Gutekunst in Green Bay and that front office. I think it's a little bit more, to be honest, Russ in the front office and the front office and Russ, than it is in particular the marriage of Pete and Russell.
I don't know that I agree with you, but I admire the thought, and I think that would be great if Russ could separate those two things out. I'm not sure he does.
Okay. All right. Now, my number two, you ready for my number two headline?
Yeah.
This Hawks Seahawks offense is the fastest any of these folks have ever seen. And by fastest, I mean vertical threats. By fastest, I mean, wow, in and out of the huddle. By fastest, with all this pre-snap motion and movement. And my gosh, the folks on the sidelines, everybody watching's like, sheesh, this thing is moving, right? They're not back at that elephant pace of huddling, got to call timeout, burning too much clock.
Play a game.
They are playing with a tempo and a speed and the word urgency, which is what Russell wanted when this whole thing started with Dan Patrick way back when, and both, you know, just in movement on the field and in everything else. So if number one, my Seahawks D line dominates and they're really tough, well, you counteract that by playing with tremendous tempo, great speed, and attack.
It's funny. Your second one and my second one are absolutely connected, so we can kind of focus on them together, because my second headline I want to hear is Shane Waldron is an Einstein-level genius. I mean, I think we all knew that was true after the whole BBN coaching thing.
Oh, boy.
Who has play calls short enough for them to get out of the huddle with more than 5 seconds left on the play clock.
That's going to be a problem. Yeah. Well, he's got some really long play calls.
Does he?
Look at the Rams, the Niners, and the Packers. I think I did this study last year when I was doing NFL games. The teams that like burn the most offensive timeouts, those typically come out of this tree.
Blah.
There's a lot of language. Blah. There's a lot of pre-snap movement. There's a lot of checks.
Blah. Just talking through this a little, Jake got back from Camp Russ down in San Diego installing this thing, and he was like, yeah, there's some wordy mouthful plays here.
Yes. Like upwards of 17 to 19 words. Like pretty long. Long plays.
I don't. I don't understand how you can have something that is so long that you can't get out of the huddle and you have to burn these stupid timeouts.
Yeah.
Fine. Then I will. Let me rephrase. Okay. If that is just not possible, Seahawks agree to take 5-yard penalties instead of wasting stupid timeouts in second half. How's that?
Oh, in second half. I like that disclaimer. Okay.
Yeah, I don't care. You blow all the first half timeouts you want. Those things are worthless. But your second half timeouts, when you got to come back at the end of a game, and don't blow those.
I think a better one was Pete Carroll, John Schneider joined competition committee to try to get 5 second half timeouts
and 5 seconds added to the play clock.
That actually probably is more realistic.
Can we just get an extra timeout in the second half?
Do you think they can be as fast as you? Forgetting about their speed and tempo, but just in terms of how much speed they'll have on the field at any point, do you think this can be the fastest Seahawks offense we've seen?
Kind of got to see receivers 4 and 5 in that conversation. And Chris Carson is definitely fast, is incredibly fast for his size, but he's not Alvin Kamara.
He's not a burner.
No, he's not a total burner. DK is world class. Tyler, at this phase and stage of his career, is not as fast as he once was, but his efficiency and his route running and all of that compensate, so he kind of is. And then we'll get to see Mr. Eskridge and whether that 4-3-8 comes to life on the field, as we've seen with other rookies in this league. I mean, that's one thing that can equate here pretty quickly, that can translate very, very fast, pun intended, is that kind of juice at the receiver position, right? DK, his rookie year, we saw that right away. The Kansas City Chiefs guys, that we see right away. The speed is one thing that you hope can really translate very, very quickly. And if he is as fast as he is on paper, then they're going to be pretty darn dynamic. And throw in Gerald Everett, that can really run at tight end, because I think you're going to see a bunch of 2 tight end stuff as well. So I think they've got an opportunity to be as explosive and fast as any group that we've seen here in Seattle.
Okay. Number 3.
Last one for me. That the 2020 draft class, the two guys that you spent top 50 picks on, Daryl Taylor and Jordan Brooks, are emerging difference makers. Wow. Look at these two guys built out of granite and can run. Because you referenced that Tampa Bay team, that's what their front had. They not only had, Jason Pierre-Paul and Shaq Barrett and guys that could win one-on-one on the edge, they had linebackers that could run like the wind. And you have two guys here that are going to play linebacker. By all accounts, Daryl Taylor is going to play and get the opportunity to fill K.J. Wright in big base personnel, and Jordan's going to fill his spot in nickel personnel, playing that weak side linebacker. And those two you drafted in the first two picks of that 2020 draft, and they can both run. They both look exactly the way you want them to look off the bus. And now they've got to play and take the next step for Brooks with confidence, and for Taylor to be durable, reliable, and available for this team.
Yes, please. Where do I sign up for that? Right? And I don't know which of those guys is more important, but yes, please.
Probably Jordan Brooks is more important.
Are you sure?
Because he's going to play a little bit more snaps.
Well, but fine. But it, but if you could have either
of those
guys.
And he had seasoning a year ago, right? And he played a year ago. There's going to be a learning curve.
Either of those
Taylor.
Two guys could turn, if you could wave your magic Brock wand and turn one of those two guys into a superstar at his position, isn't there more value with Daryl Taylor?
If he's a pass rusher as well, yeah. If he's an early down, yes. And can get you 8 sacks and third down, yes.
Right?
Yes.
I mean, that's more value than a middle linebacker.
Than a weak side linebacker,
right.
Yes.
So I agree with you, though. I mean, I think you're probably more likely to see it from Jordan Brooks. And I've liked that pick, and I think he fits with where the NFL is going and that kind of hybrid thing where he can run, especially with tight ends, when other teams try to do the two tight end thing to you, et cetera. So... yeah, I think that would be great. I hope it happens. I hope we actually just get to see Daryl Taylor at some
point. And if they're both on the field for this mandatory camp for all the practices and available and can go, there will be headlines written about them because they just looked apart. Because
you need it. Because you haven't hit on a star defensive player in forever. Right?
Frank Clark was, I think.
Yeah, since Frank Clark. And then you let him go and didn't give him a second contract.
Yep.
By the way, I was in support of that at the time, so that's not a criticism, but like it's been since Frank Clark.
Of your own, yes, that you've drafted and developed and brought along.
So it's been a little while. Mine is Gabe Jackson personally transforms this into a top offensive line. Because last year they were not. Last year, what ended up essentially beating them in the playoffs, as you said, Brock, a defensive line that wasn't able to do much of anything or force turnovers, and an offensive line that was completely manhandled by the Rams. So the only real major change they've made to that offensive line, other than Damian Lewis getting a year older, which I think is a good thing, is that they brought in Gabe Jackson. Other than that, basically looks the same. That and Shane Waldron, right, and sort of a different concept. So I hope that Gabe Jackson and whatever they're changing to their system is enough to transform this into a top offensive line, because I still believe that will be a whole lot more important than drafting Dwayne Eskridge.
Because if 4 beats 5, I mean, the Rams could rush 3 and could beat your 5. Because Aaron Donald beats 3 guys.
They could rush 1 or 2, and you still don't have
They could probably rush Aaron Donald, Leonard Floyd alone.
You'd be like, I can't handle these two.
That's right. And I don't know how we block them. I don't know how we got to chip and keep guys in and do all of it. So, yeah, I don't know if Gabe's going to have that kind of an impact. Certainly in a mandatory minicamp kind of feel, be very, very hard to judge that. That's going to be, week one of the season and just how stout. It's one thing, Daniel Jeremiah, remember that tweet vividly from a couple years ago that, his scouting and where this league has changed in so many ways and it continues to always evolve is he's like, man, you need to have those guards that have significant punch. Because if you let Aaron Donald and Fletcher Cox and these guys puncture you from the inside out as quickly as those guys can, we've watched it. That's where Russell's frustration is paramount. And we're like, man, I don't have a chance. Like, okay, elite pass rusher on the outside, I could step up, I could step around, I could spin out, I could do all the things I need to do. When Aaron Donald and Fletcher Cox are these guys are in my
right
lap,
on my grill.
Yeah, before I can take 3 steps, I'm dead. It's dead on arrival.
I'm so glad you bring it up that way. It's why I continue, and this kind of leads us to the Jamal Adams conversation. It's why I still get annoyed, and when we used to talk to Clayton about this, it would bother me to no end of like, well, you can't pay him that. He's a safety. Well, you can't pay him that. He's a guard. Well, the idea that like everything in like this game is so interconnected.
Yep.
Oh, guards aren't as valuable as tackles. Okay, well, tell that to Aaron Donald, because eventually smart teams look at it and say, your guards stink. You're not paying for guards. You're only paying for tackles. So what are we going to do? We're going to rush the quarterback up the middle instead of off the edge.
Yep.
Well, what's the difference? Like, if you're a quarterback, I get what you just said, Brock. Sometimes it's almost better to have them coming off the edge than up the middle. But the point of why offensive tackles, why did they get to be expensive? Because the defensive ends were so good. But it was all about pressuring the quarterback. If the pressure comes up the middle instead of off the edge,
correct.
It's still pressure and it still screws up your game plan.
Yeah, it's why.
No, but you can't pay a guard. Yep. No, you just can't pay them. They're not worth it. Why not?
If
having expensive guards is ruining your game, then you need to pay for guards.
Yes. Because I believe it was what did the Giants call it? NASCAR way back when?
Absolutely.
when they beat the undefeated Patriots, and they put 4 pass rushers out there and said, all right, yeah, your tackle's pretty good, Nate Solder's pretty good, and your base protection's pretty good, but can you block these 4? Can your guards block these guys, Justin Tuck, in passing situations? And that answer in that Super Bowl was no.
Justin Tuck, Michael Strahan, OCU Manure.
Oh, and there's another tall guy. Gosh, I remember that. I'm looking at him.
It wasn't Matthias Kiwanuka, was it?
Could have been. I think it was.
Is that who it was?
Well done.
All right.
That was the name that I had stuck in my head.
All right, there we go.
Good job.
There we go.
There you go.
Okay.
So let's put Strahan on the right edge of that guard. I know he's better, and I know he spends his lifetime beating tackles, but would you like to be the guard?
Right. Well, since they've paid $3 for a guard and a gazillion dollars for the tackle, like, sure, let Strahan go dominate that guy instead. And I don't know. I just that whole thing sort of frustrates me. And if I were Jamal Adams, I'd be pretty frustrated right now. Right.
Is that his personal family issue, you think?
Yeah, my personal family issue is you're calling me a safety. I had 9.5 sacks.
Yep.
What safety are you talking about? You want to pay me as a safety? I had 9. I led the team in sacks in like a few games. Like what? I generally am like I get to be a team guy in these things of like, yeah, sorry, this is sort of what the but in the Jamal Adams case, like this dude's got so much leverage.
So are you paying him more than Bobby? You paying him more than $18 million a year? You're not paying him as an elite pass rusher. It's not what he is.
Are you sure?
He's not doing that
He was an elite pass rusher last year.
He's not doing that down in and down out.
He gets 9.5 sacks.
He gets to come on blitzes.
But he had 9.5 sacks.
Sure he did.
Well, so elite is production. He has elite production
You want to play D-line now, Jamal? Is that what you want to do?
No,
you want to play
this? Elite production at that position. Production.
But you're not a D-lineman.
No, but he had elite production. What is the point of those D-linemen? Why do they get paid? They get paid for getting after the quarterback. He did that. The D-linemen also are good at setting an edge. Okay, that's not his specialty, but he can also run after tight ends down the field.
Sure.
What D-lineman is doing that? So
you're going to pay him? Pay him what?
You're
going to pay him $21 million like a D-lineman? You're going to pay him over $18 million like Bobby Wagner? Are you going to pay him 15 like safeties and the highest safety would make?
I thankfully don't have to pay him as much as Bobby Wagner because of the stupidity of the NFL system. Because the NFL has all like, I mean, really what it is should be illegal. I mean, like they're all conspiring to create these markets. This is, if this were baseball, the union would have like had an uprising decades ago. Mm-hmm. This is... You know, there's a big word out there. Like, I don't know if I want to use it or not, because once you use it, right, then everything kind of changes. But, you know, kind of seems like it, right?
Well, side of it, or the other side of it is we have a cap, and this is the structure that it fits in. And does everybody buy into it? Yes, they do. Do all 32 teams do it? Yes, they do.
It's ridiculous. But if I'm the team, I'm going to take advantage of it. I'm giving him a few dollars more than Buda Baker, right? You get to set the market. You're the highest paid safety.
Yep.
It's ridiculous because he's not just a safety. The league is going to an amorphous system on the back and on defense anyway.
Sure.
Right? I mean, like, that's how you beat the spread. And the more you see the spread, the more you see these amorphous, positionless kind of defenses. And Jamal Adams plays all over the field. What do you mean he's a safety?
That's a good word, by the way. Do you think if I use that word in a
amorphous?
Broadcast?
Amorphous.
Yeah. What would happen if I use that in a broadcast? How many people would understand that word?
You get a lot of head scratches.
Now that you're going back to college football, very little.
Especially like Big 12 college football.
Right.
Yikes.
Yeah. Good luck. I'm sure the Oklahoma grads in Norman know what that
means. You could also say positionless. But
I did
amorphous.
Say positionless. I said both.
Oh, very good. Very good. I like it. I may have to write that one down.
And that's what I'm saying. If I'm Jamal Adams, my argument is I don't have a position. I'm a defensive player.
And if you're the Seahawks, you say you're a safety who had zero interceptions, three passes defense,
because
and you don't do anything a typical safety does.
Cool. Then why'd you just trade two first-round picks for me? Feel free to let me go.
You think because Jamal had, hold on a second.
Well, but
you
think, all right, but they're gonna they can't just let him go after giving up two first-round picks.
You think Jamal has more leverage, huh?
Yes.
Really?
Legitimately, I think he has a ton of leverage. I think if they don't sign Jamal Adams, it is an epic embarrassment for the organization.
Well,
who has more leverage, like in their history? Cam Chancellor when he was holding out, or Jamal Adams right now?
Jamal Adams,
because of the trade, they already anteed up.
They already said they admitted tacitly that they are going to pay him. You gave up two first round picks and a player for this guy. Well, you can do that for 2 years and see you later. Anybody who's willing to do that should be out of their job.
No, they would say, hold on a second.
That's absurd.
They would say, hold on a second. We're fine. we'll let you play out your final year of your deal. Oh, and then by the way, we'll franchise you. And you know what you're going to be franchised at, Jimmy Graham? You're going to be franchised as a safety
that's what he says, I'm not going to play.
Okay, then don't play. Then don't make any money.
We've seen this, though. We've seen how this goes. I mean, like, I'm not saying that they won't eventually, that the Seahawks don't have any leverage whatsoever, but ultimately they need to sign him.
They do, and ultimately Jamal needs to make his money, because ultimately Jamal can look at what happened to Cam and Earl, who both held out, Cam for 65 days and got nothing, and Earl for training camp and got nothing, and
I'll
he can look
what,
at that
man,
and go.
I think he's got more leverage than either of those
guys. I think he does, too, right now.
A lot more.
But he also has not made, you know, in his mind, the next major contract, which
I think that'll be an interesting
game changer.
You bring up the idea of being franchised. If I'm him, I mean, is he going to go down the Jimmy Graham, everyone else who's done this road on the franchise? Like, what do you mean?
Of course,
safety. Not safety. He had 9.5 sacks.
Yep. Of course.
You're going to judge me on picks like Kyle wants to over there? I had 9.5 sacks.
Yep.
Like, what are you talking about?
I can't play safety. I can't play pass defense. Okay, safety, that'll be your death.
Yeah.
Well, if I'm him, I'm looking at him going, well, tell me, show me how you value sacks for a safety in what is essentially arbitration, right? Oh, you don't. So why would you put, like, you're calling me a safety just because that's
what that's what you were
called.
Drafted as.
But no,
because
but
that's what you've been
called.
Your whole life.
Well, that's what I'm called, but it's just a name. It's just a term.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't mean anything other than it's a term.
Well, it's what all the other guys play in the sleeves with Justin Simmons. And you mentioned Buda Baker. Buda comes down and he plays in the box. He comes down, he covers in the slot. He comes down, he rushes the passer. He comes down, he does all of those things as well. That's what safeties in the NFL do today.
But it's just a name. It's just a term. And for some reason, the NFL has put values on these different positions based on their name. It doesn't follow with the way the game is being played now, and certainly for guys who break molds like Jamal Adams. He is not a traditional safety. Yep. He breaks the mold. Kyle's right about it. He does have challenges in pass coverage that other safeties are better at. He also has unique skills that other safeties don't come close to.
Correct.
The other part of it for me, Brock, and I think there's another reason why the Seahawks I do not have as much leverage, is one of the reasons, not the only one, but one of the reasons they went after this guy and traded as much as they did for him is that they wanted a leader,
yes,
a spiritual leader, emotional leader in their locker room. You really want to make your emotional leader that mad where you're gonna franchise him every year? And like, what is the point of that? Hey, I really want to bring you in. I want to build this thing around you. Okay. Well, but I'm going to be incredibly mean to you at every turn. What? Why? Well, cool. Then you're not going to get all the leadership you want. I mean, I'll go out and play because that's the job, but I'm not going to be your emotional leader. Yep. Why would I do that if you're not going to commit to me? I'm not going to commit to you. So I totally disagree on this one. I generally am with you and say team has the ability to do all these different things, and the league is essentially... The system is there to job the player and help the team.
So what is reasonable?
I actually put
So what's reasonable? What's reasonable? Because that's what this is about.
Bobby makes 18, Buddha makes 15, right?
Yep.
Roughly?
I think Justin Simmons is like 15.5 average per year.
Split the difference. 15.25. Give him 16.5 and let's go.
Yep.
I mean, at some point.
I think they would do that tomorrow.
Oh, so you think he won't do that? You think he wants more than Bobby?
Oh, absolutely. I think he's he's totally unreasonable. I think his team is unreasonable. I say this totally out of speculation.
Right. There's no
I'm not speaking
of that,
for the team. Well, in New York, he worked his way out of there. He hated it there.
But everybody would work their way out of that dump.
Yep.
Who can blame him?
I also think this is about what I get up front. This is a guy that's had now two shoulder surgeries, thumb surgery. He plays a violent game. He can look around and say, wow, you know, the guy that I'm probably the closest comp to in this league the last 10 years just had to retire with a neck injury in Seattle, by the way, and didn't see every last dollar and certainly didn't have a 15-year career to capitalize and maximize. And even the other guy that played in Seattle kind of blew his way out of Seattle, out of this league as well. And I got a body that's not going to play 15 years in a style and a game that's not going to play 15 years. No, I need my money and I need it now. And I not only want more than $16.5 million, I want a huge signing bonus. I want it in my bank account ASAP.
The Seahawks should do that. the cap's going to go crazy. Like, how excited are they going to be in 2 years when he's making $18 million and you've already paid his money and the salary cap is 50% higher than it is right now? You'll be stoked. Like, this is, I don't understand why the Seahawks are even dragging their feet in any way. Pay him $20 million with a ton of guaranteed money in front.
I don't understand why they started negotiating a week ago. Why wasn't this offseason priority number one? Why were you dealing with Michael Dixon before? Like, to me, this is what you have to get done.
You think they just started a week ago?
Well, that was Brady's report, is that as of a week ago, negotiations started.
Interesting. That would surprise me. I don't know whose camp that's coming from, but that would surprise me with the magnitude of this deal, with everything that you said, the leverage that he does have, because yeah, they have anteed up.
That doesn't mean that there weren't, like, you know, a couple of things, but like negotiations for real.
Gotcha.
Like the real, you know how it is.
And right? That's kind of how the
like
Seahawks
when you,
do
when you
things.
Put on your little like reverse lights, like I'm going into this space over here, not like I'm driving around the parking lot looking for spaces.
Not my blinkers on.
Right, like blinkers on, park reverse lights, or I'm backing into this space.
I am now moving backwards.
Right. Like I'm signaling my intent that I want to make a deal instead of I want to put this
Who offer sends on. The first offer? You send the offer. No, you send it.
Right.
Let me see the terms of the deal. Let me see how you want to structure the deal. Go ahead. Send it my way. And when that comes via fax right off the machine, and Jamal and his family and his agent look at it, what is the initial response? How low ball does one side go? How high did Jamal send that? Okay, you want to get a deal done? I want, you know, 20
Jamal
million a
year. 25 a year.
Yes.
Like, okay, and then the Seahawks counter with like 10, and then eventually they're still going to meet in that 16.5-17 range is my guess. But yeah,
here's the other element of that, and we all get just, and it's easy to bite into just the pure dollars, right, and the guaranteed dollars and everything else. The other thing is the structure, and as Jamal is saying, I'm not doing a deal like Russ and Bobby. You kidding me? I'm not going along those lines. I'm not doing a team-friendly deal so you guys can spread out your number and it could be an extension on my deal this upcoming year. And I don't want just 2 years of guarantee. We're not doing that. Like, I'm Jamal Adams. I'm the marquee player. I'm the edge that you need. You're going to keep me to your point. You're going to make me happy.
They're going to have to.
I'm not going to settle for anything.
They are going to have to because they gave up so much to get him. Unless they think they can get that back or something very close to it. Yeah, like I honestly believe that this is a time where they have their backs against the wall a little bit. And that kind of leads you to the last part here. And that's following up on what Daniel Jeremiah told us last week, Brock, of this idea that this is sort of a last run for them, right? That they've got to be all in because if it doesn't work, this marriage is short term.
That's why the Julio Jones thing to me made sense with them, which is just a full all chips in. Let's really go for this thing on this last run here with Russell. If not, you don't have any picks next year. If you wanted to at that point in time, if this whole thing doesn't work and you just, you know, you're a one and done in the playoffs, or you don't make the postseason, the time would probably be right to make the trade and get some picks and try and rebuild this thing. So it definitely feels like this is a short-term marriage we have here with Russell and the Seahawks. And so if that's the case, let's you know, make a run at it.
So regardless of whether he's right, I don't know that anyone knows whether or not this is a short-term run with Russ and the Seahawks. I think that's a lot of speculation. But do you like the whole last dance concept? I mean, it was
all
interesting
in.
To hear DJ say, like, yeah, we tried that three times on three different teams. It never worked.
Yeah, tried it in Baltimore with a veteran crew with a lot of equity and established stars and Steve McNair, and didn't work. Tried in Cleveland after one good year, and that was never going to work with Derek Anderson. And then ultimately the dream team in Philly with Vince Young, who, you know, again.
He had some quarterback issues there.
Yeah. And two of those three significant issues, and McNair, a totally beat up guy at that stage of his career.
How often does the all in for one last run work? I mean, obviously it worked, you know, the
in
last
Tampa
dance.
Last year, and we'll see if it's going to work in Tampa this year. Right?
Worked for the Broncos and Peyton Manning in the 2 years they did that.
Yep. And, oh, by the way, I think an important part in context to this is you say, well, hold on a second. 10 years ago, we're not really having this conversation because franchise quarterbacks don't move because franchise quarterbacks are there forever. Right. That's all fine. But 10 years ago, we have this conversation. It's really a non-starter. That's not the case. Tom Brady left freaking New England and divorced Bill Belichick. Aaron Rodgers is on his way out of Green Bay after being the MVP of the league. Right? Even Philip Rivers and some of the other guys at the end of their careers are moving. Oh, yeah, Russell's going to be here forever. Well, that's not the way the script. Deshaun Watson's not going to be a Texan. And he's going to be out a young emerging star, and maybe that's as much off the field as it turns out now as it is on the field. But the context of the game is different. Mm. Tom, to me, changed some of that. Aaron is changing some of that. And don't think Russell isn't and hasn't looked at those two situations and played a role with some of his offseason noise early in this year as well. So, yeah, I think it's a, I think it's a different conversation than it was even 5 years ago. I think it is a year-by-year deal now, and it didn't work, you know, work for Julio, but what about Stephon Gilmore? So he's the next one kind of in line. If you didn't go that route with Julio, do you want to give up a second-round pick, your second-round pick?
I'm a lot more willing to do it for Stephon Gilmore.
Me too.
Like the Julio thing, like, I'm sorry, wide receivers don't win Super Bowls.
Nope.
They just don't. You got to have them. I'm not saying you don't need good wide receivers, but having like the crazy wide receiver core, it just doesn't win Super Bowls.
No, it doesn't.
So, all right. Having one of the best corners in the league to go with, you know, a couple of really good Pro Bowl safeties and, you know, some enhancements that you've made to your defensive line, linebacker room. Like, yeah, yes. You could talk me into Stephon Gilmore. Guy was the defensive player of the year a year ago.
Yes.
2019. I know he's coming off a little injury, but like, yeah, you could absolutely talk me into that rental.
Yes.
Totally different situation for me.
And I think at this stage, Russell going into year 10, Bobby kind of nearing the end of a Hall of Fame career. I think there's, you know, Pete and John would never do it. Maybe Pete in some ways would a little bit more than John. John's here 2025. His walls are full of all sorts of scenarios looking out over the next year, 2 years, 3 years, right, as he puts his puzzle pieces together. But yeah, I would not say, wow, it didn't work for Daniel Jeremiah in Baltimore, Cleveland, and Philly. You know, it's never works. I wouldn't look at it in that regard.
Right.
I'd look at it where this game is going, where even these marquee franchise, the best of the best, are leaving their programs near the end of their careers and realize that may be the avenue here over the long term with Russ.
The only, and I'm kind of with you on all of that, and the idea of trading for Stephon Gilmore if it's a second round pick, like, yeah, I think that's probably something you have to do. But I think that's where the problem is that it's a have to in some ways.
Yep.
Like, you know, and it hasn't really worked that well for you. I mean, the two guys that kind of come to mind, and maybe I'm missing a few, are Clowney and Sheldon Richardson, who you kind of traded for in that style. And Clowney was good, not great, didn't end up re-signing and essentially never did much again. Richardson was good, not great, was certainly not as good as he had been when he was with the Jets. I mean, you don't have a lot of luck with the, hey, rent the guy and give up some picks for him.
Well, Dwayne Brown, I would say, was a have to.
And yeah, I guess that's true. That's good.
Dunlap. They had to sign him with just
but that's a fifth rounder. That's a late Diggs. Like those are guys you're giving up super late. I mean, guys that you're spending some significant resource on in order to bring them in. Yeah, it's a good point. I hadn't thought of Dwayne Brown.
Yeah,
the real issue though is that you have to keep doing this.
Yes,
you don't want to have to. It's not to say that you can't do it occasionally, but why did you have to do it for Dwayne Brown? Because you haven't been able to draft tackle.
Yep.
Why did you have to do it for Clowney? Because you decided not to re-sign Frank Clark and you hadn't drafted anybody who could take his place. Why did you have to do it for Sheldon Richardson? Because Malik McDowell destroyed himself and your team in the process.
Yep.
Like why are you looking at a Stephon Gilmore? Because unfortunately you haven't drafted a corner that can live up to being a number one corner in this league. And Shaquille Griffin was not that. He was good, but he wasn't great.
Yep.
So there's a lot of these have to's that and they all stem from this conversation we've had before of just unable to find as many, not necessarily superstars, but Pro Bowlers in the draft as you did early in your tenure here.
Yep. And look around at the teams that are kind of thriving in this league. And you are thriving. You're one of the top 10 teams in this league. Because you got it right at the most important position of all with Russell Wilson way back when. And that has a long tail in this league. But Kansas City hit on their young stars, a bunch of them, Tyreek Hill and Patrick Mahomes and, you know, the defensive linemen, a bunch of Tampa Bay Buccaneers. Yes, it was Tom Brady and Fournette and you bring in some nice additions and Gronk and everything else. But you were right on your linebackers. You were right on your other D linemen. You're right on your offensive linemen. You're right on your young receivers. So yeah, you've got to hit and you got to be right with those young players and developing them into not just good players, but elite great players.
Let me end the Jamal Adams thing here as news sort of comes out. This is a little challenging doing this while we're on tape here. But Tom Pelissero says the Seahawks have excused safety Jamal Adams from this week's mandatory minicamp for personal reasons. You know what this tells me? They're going to get a deal done.
Working now, look, in good faith?
Yeah, I mean, look, maybe there is something actually going on with Jamal Adams' family, or like I want to be sensitive to the fact that you know, maybe there actually is something going on, and it's a huge coincidence that a guy in a contract, you know, situation like this actually has something going on that he needs
for
to
the 3 days of the entire offseason.
Right. I mean, but hey, yeah. Let's be sensitive to the fact that maybe something's happened to his family, and I don't know. I those things absolutely do occur, so yes. I don't want to just make light of it, and like we did earlier. Like there's certainly the possibility that that's the case. Let's assume for the moment that it's not, and, you know, strike me down if it turns out to be. That, to me, is a signal that the Seahawks are saying, all right, we want to work with you. We want to get this done.
Yep.
We'll excuse it. We understand you got to do what you got to do, but let's work out a deal so that we don't have to keep doing this.
Let's be reasonable. Let's work in good faith. We're not going to make a big deal of this.
Yep.
This is a way, once again, for Pete and John to quiet any of the media. Not going to ask about it. Not going to be any conversation about it. Not going to be any, he's a complicated guy comments. It is, yep, he's excused. Got personal stuff going on. We'll act in good faith. We're negotiating now. We're going to work behind the scenes to get this done. And yeah, let's hope the two sides can be reasonable. If both sides are reasonable, this deal will get done.
Yep. Totally agree on that. Father's Day this weekend, Brock. Are you ready?
U.S. Open this weekend, Michael.
Well, I'm definitely ready for that. I think you know I am. A little fear yesterday when Jordan had his little ankle injury, but it seems like everything's going to be okay. So no.
You didn't like his outfits, though. I'll tell you that.
What is going on?
Sorry.
What is Under Armour doing?
I don't know. That black and gray look, all of it. Horrible.
The pink. The like. There's a light
the
pink
X
and a bright,
on the back.
All of it.
X marks the spot.
Honestly,
horrible.
I feel like he's been like held hostage now by
look
Under
good.
Armour.
Look good. Feel good, play good, yeah. And you're just totally disrupting the first domino.
Let me just keep this simple for okay. Jordan and his whole team at Under Armour. I'll keep it very simple. White pants. Just keep him in navy.
And white.
Light gray and white.
Yep.
Don't let him wear any other colors.
Nope.
Navy, light gray, and white. That's it.
Winter.
That's what works for him. Like, don't change
winter,
it.
Winter, chicken dinner.
So I was in Boston, what, last week, right? So we'll get to chicken dinners here in a second. I was in Boston last week visiting my family and went to see my grandfather, who is going to be 99 this month.
Wow.
And unfortunately, his health is not where he would like it to be or any of us would like it to be right now. He was in the hospital when I went to go visit him. And he kind of wakes up and it takes him a moment or two to kind of clear his head and kind of snap back in. But within a few minutes, one of us was like, "Wow, what happened to Jordan last week?" It's like, "Oh my god!" Like,
you can't escape
awesome.
It,
right?
You have to answer for Jordan Spieth everywhere.
Seriously,
you go.
Yep. I have to answer for Jordan Spieth, and then generally he takes some shot at Chambers Bay about how like it's the ugliest yellow course he'd ever seen at a U.S. Open. It's like even from his hospital bed, he's like taking
Grandpa,
shots.
All right.
I know.
I like that course.
So I was trying to help him put something on. He was in the cardiac unit, so I'm helping him put something on TV because they had put soccer on there for him. Like any red-blooded American, he hates soccer. And so he's like, what is this? Turn this off. So I was looking for the Red Sox game for him, and I was like, then I had a pause. Like, I wonder if they don't let the Red Sox be played in the cardiac unit. Like, that doesn't seem like a good idea around here.
We are now invoking the Larry Salk rule on floor 5.
Yes.
All TVs will be going off.
Right. So I ended up putting on some Champions Tour golf for him.
Well,
I figured
very
that was
peaceful.
Like, let's see Miguel Angel Jimenez just kind of casually walking around. Doesn't that seem like it makes the most sense?
Get a little Mike Weir out there.
Yeah. Well, with Father's Day, the other one is, so I was watching my dad. My dad is playing in, I think it's 3 softball leagues, but it's hard to keep track. He's retired. So his whole life now has become about.
Is he 70?
He's 72.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
So his whole life has become about playing softball and all these different leagues. And he's like, you know, there's spreadsheets and they keep stats. And he's actually having a really good, he's hitting like 680 in one of his leagues or something.
Ooh,
he's
playing well. Popular.
So Cecily and I go over to watch him play. I sent you guys one of the videos. Unfortunately, in that game, he went 5 for 6 in the 2 games that day. I sent you the one that was a fielder's choice. But the amount of guys that play in these leagues, and it is one of those moments where you're like, you know, if your entire generation grows up obsessed with baseball, right? And in Boston, that's the 67 and 75 Red Sox that both went to the World Series and didn't win, and then eventually, right, 86, and eventually winning in 04. They lived that whole thing. And so you have hundreds, really thousands and thousands of guys at that age group who are obsessed with the game of baseball that now play softball, and they all know the game. They don't move very fast. They play with 5 infielders and 4 outfielders. Literally, Brock. They have five infielders, so there's a guy standing on second base in addition to your four infielders, and you have four outfielders, and still they score like 20 runs
and still,
a game.
Yeah, well, Popolari's finding holes out to hit 700.
Absolutely.
And still more action from the 70-year-olds than Major League Baseball.
They don't move too far.
Yeah, I don't think so. Yeah, I don't imagine they move a whole lot.
But they all know the game. They don't make mental mistakes. Like, they all have, like, a pretty good... It's not like a Little League game where the ball's getting thrown all over the place, because they all grew up obsessed with this game, and it does show you, like, kind of what the Kraken are trying to do with getting people interested, not just in watching hockey, but playing it, and why they're doing the whole thing at Northgate, because once you get into a sport like that, it doesn't leave you, and it kind of goes back and forth. Watching it makes you want to play it. Playing it makes you want to watch it. I don't know. It just sort of crystallized for me watching the whole thing.
I liked his speed, man. And he wears a jock strap when he plays softball, too.
Kyle liked the Bostonian, the Boston accents. And the
go hard! Go hard! Yeah. Immediately. Run hard!
Run hard!
Run hard!
Oh, yeah. Yep.
He's running hard. Like, he is running hard. He's running really hard.
How much hotter can he run? He's going to be in the cardiac unit if he runs any hotter.
He can't run any hotter.
Oh my gosh. Anyway, so there you go. Plus, it's pretty fun being around. You get to see a whole bunch of characters. Guy shows up with his yellow lab, older guy with big old yellow lab, beautiful girl. And dog's like pulling on the leash and doing rolling around on the ground. Go. Comes over and he's like, she hates people, huh? And she's like jumping on me. and I just had her out running with four other dogs for like 2.5 hours. No problem. Like but you get, I don't know, the characters that you find are. It was quite a trip. So, yes, Father's Day this weekend, Brock. You mentioned chicken dinner. How about this? Forget breakfast in bed. Let Famous Dave's do all the cooking. Catering specials for the class of 21 graduations. And now, of course, for the fathers in your life for Father's Day this weekend, get this done. They start at just $10 a person, okay? Here you go. $10. Georgia chopped pork, barbecue pulled chicken sliders, choice of two sides.
Okay.
Add $2, $12 a person, Georgia chopped pork, still, barbecued pulled chicken sliders. Now we're going to add in the traditional chicken wings and the choice of two sides. Mm. I love chicken wings, man. Mm. I love barbecue chicken. Like, I think I've kind of soured on buffalo chicken wings in my old age. They're too spicy. Yep. They're too vinegar. Like, at the end, like, I don't feel good. But, like, just a straight-up fried chicken wing has not gone out of style. It's just a beautiful thing. Yes, I'm with you. $14 will get you Georgia chopped pork, barbecue pulled chicken sliders, and St. Louis-style spare ribs, of course, with two sides. Spare ribs still my favorite. So those are all options for Father's Day. Famous Dave's Authentic Barbecue is behind everything. Their pitmasters get the hickory logs smoldering in their smokers around
4 a.m., baby.
Every day, hand rub the meats with fresh spices, and then slow cook them to perfection. How about that? That's why they've proudly won more than 700 awards. They are an authority in the barbecue world. You can find them in Everett, Tukwila, Tacoma, and...
Got that spooky ghost kitchen, baby!
Northgate, Seattle. More info, go to famousdaves.com/catering. Got to the first Mariner game I've been to since opening day last night, Brock. Actually going again tonight, so I'm going to two Mariner games in a row. It was awesome being there. Like, legitimately, so that last night was the sort of the first time they'd opened it up to 30,000, so there were more people there. They had the whole vaccinated section, so didn't need to wear a mask, which was great. Was able to go, like, if you've been vaccinated, they go, you get the, like, a stamp, right, as you're walking in. I washed myself and still have a stamp left there. Yeah, so I kind of feel like I've been to a...
Well, you'll be ready for tonight.
Cool club, and I was with a buddy of mine who's from out of town. He's a Twins fan, so we were kind of walking around and... Brought him over. He'd never been to the parks. He went over to the Pen and sure enough, there's trance music and saw these girls walking in,
they had their five bachelorette parties are all there.
Their glow sticks or whatever it is you need for that. But it was fun. It was honestly great. And one of the great perks of working here is having really good seats to games. And the charter seats we have are my favorite by far. Where you sit over by the first base, right behind the camera well on the first baseline, right by the Mariners dugout. They're the best seats. I love watching the game from that angle. You really get such a sense of the size, the speed, and kind of what's going on in the dugout. So I did have a few observations. Miguel Sano is bigger than you realize. And I know you realize he's big. He's bigger than that.
He plays on a team with Nelson Cruz.
He's so much bigger than Nelson Cruz. He's gigantic.
No, thank you. I'll pass.
And that you know who else is a really big dude is Taylor Trammell. Like, I didn't realize he was that big watching him on TV. See him in person. Like, oh, man. The two of them almost collided at first base. It's like, he would have gotten the worst of that. Yeah. Don't get me wrong. Like, Sano is the biggest baseball player. He's Willie Mopena big. I think he might be the biggest baseball player I've ever seen.
Sandoval?
Sandoval's fat, but he's short. This guy's just gigantic. I can't, like, he does not look like
the Rock at Gibraltar over there. He's just sitting there. He is not moving. Man,
he's huge. He's really gigantic as a human being. But the guy who stands out, Brock, and you probably would guess this, but as I watch the Mariners both in the dugout and on the field from very close over the course of a game, which player do you think stood out more than any other?
More than J.P. Crawford?
Nope, J.P. Crawford.
Yep.
It's unbelievable. Like, you can't watch without noticing him.
Hmm.
And I know, Brock, you were saying last week, and we kind of got into whether or not, like, you know, he was worth, what did you say, 12 wins?
I said 5 to 10. I think they'd be 5 games under 500 or 10 games under 500.
That might be a lot. But I will say, like, watching him, the energy he plays with, the fun factor, the joy, the constant conversation. He kind of kicked off the scoring in that game, hit a double, hustle double. Yeah. Hit a single, turned it into a double, and then scored on a single to kind of get them going on a night where it looked like maybe they weren't going to have that. Made a couple of really nice plays in the field. But then you just kind of watch him. Like, he missed a ball in the middle of the plate and ended up popping it up. And, like, you get to actually hear some of the cursing and, like, just seeing how angry he was about that moment. And then we saw him go into the club, into the dugout. And then we heard some banging and sort of clanging a moment later. And, like, okay, he was super mad. But then that was an inning they ended up scoring a bunch of runs and kind of had strung together 3 or 4 hits. He was the guy right on the top step, like a minute after being super angry, sort of Wassa-like, where he was like super angry and then kind of snapped back into laughing and being happy. He was, despite being obviously mad enough at himself to have smashed something in the dugout, the first guy leading the cheering and the excitement over what was like, I don't know. I love
sign
that
him.
Guy.
Sign him.
Yeah.
It's time to sign him. If you've given money to other guys, it's time to sign him. And I would sign him ahead of Mitch Haniger.
Well,
he's more valuable than Mitch Haniger. He's the best defensive player as far as runs saved in this league. He's what you just talked about. He's doing all of this while emerging. Imagine when he has total confidence and belief in himself offensively and marries those two things together. And if you pay him, he knows that, yep, I'm the voice of this team. And I think that empowers him that much more. Pay him.
The only problem with it is that you are getting ready for the greatest shortstop free agent class, like, of all time, right? Lindor is now off of it, but when you start looking at this class,
Correa and Story and
Baez, Seager,
what's his name? Kid, what's the guy who's in Toronto now? Is playing second base.
And by the way, Marte coming up? Is he a shortstop or second baseman?
He's a shortstop who may move to third, and he's a ways away.
Okay,
like, he's a ways away.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay.
A few years.
He's like 17. Like, he's really young. You got some time on him.
Pay him.
If you pay him, are you willing to move him to second, or do you think you have a shot of getting someone like Trevor Story, for instance?
Trevor Story can't play defense in the same stratosphere.
Can you move him to third base?
Can you be the Mariners?
Sign
a shortstop
and move him to third,
and have the clout to move him to third base?
Right, like, basically an A-Rod situation because you have Derek Jeter.
No.
Probably not.
No, you can't.
And I think this is
a really challenging
situation. Him is, like, if you sign J.P. Crawford, are you essentially shutting the door on any of the big name shortstops that are out there? You could move him to second, but that sure seems like a waste given everything he can. As you just said, he saved more runs than anyone in the game playing defense at shortstop. This is where it's hard. You're right. This is where it's hard to be the team that you are, the reputation you have, because it would be great to be able to sign one of those. Like, not that I don't think Trevor Story is necessarily the best one in that group, but could you sign him to play third base? Like, yeah, like, I could get kind of into that as a possibility, because I don't think you're going to have a realistic shot at Seager, Baez, or Correa. But I feel like you might have a shot at Story, and maybe teams are scared off by the Coors effect, and, like, maybe you could put him at third base, but I think that's a challenge. So I think that's why you have to hold off on signing someone like J.P. Crawford, right?
Two of those guys are likely not going anywhere, right? A Seager and a Correa are likely going to stay in their locales. I think they both love it there. And
would have said that thing for Mookie Betts, though, a couple of years ago, and yet here we are. So, maybe.
And if you're J.P. Crawford and you're the Mariners and everything of this offseason and you've done everything right, you are by far the catalyst and the voice of this team, I think you also create some goodwill in that clubhouse, Mike, by signing him. I think you create some goodwill to your fans. Yeah, we're committed here, and we're going to spend. And I think if you do it now, you're probably looking at a deal. You're probably buying it at a time where I think JP would probably want some real money. And you're not breaking the bank and having to pay him what you'd have to pay those other guys.
Yeah. Marcus Semien was the other player I was thinking of who's out there. Now, he's playing second base now. I mean, that's somebody who might be able to play second or third for you if you go in that direction. He's having a ridiculous year. He's got an 875 OPS in Toronto. He's been in the AL West and had success in Oakland. For some reason, I wanted to say Marco Scudero when I was trying to think of his name.
Not that guy.
But I knew it wasn't him. So thankfully, I was able to hold off. So it's not Marco Scudero. It's Marcus Semien. But, I mean, there are some other options. And Brock, if you do want to sign Crawford, maybe that's a way you could come back and try to continue to build your infield with a guy like Marcus Semien. But I'm not sure that there's any value in doing it now as opposed to waiting, right? I mean, like, do you need to do it right now?
Are you going to save some dollars doing it right now?
I don't know. Are you?
I would think so. I would think J.P. Crawford would strike me as a guy that would love to have some guaranteed money coming his way.
Yeah.
At this stage of his career, it's been a little bit up and down.
He's on your team and not even – he's just arbitration eligible this year. He's not a free agent until 25.
Wow.
Like, do you really feel like you have to sign him now before you know what's going on with all those other shortstops?
Wow.
He's not a free agent until 2025. I don't think I need to do that. I get what you're saying, and I understand the desire to commit to him. But I and maybe there's one of those deals where you can kind of help him out and avoid the arbitration process with like a deal that takes him until 25.
Yep.
But you really don't have to. I mean, he's not going to make huge money in arbitration because he's not hitting home runs, right? Like, his offensive numbers aren't going to translate to big money. So I get where you're coming from, and he does stand out. I don't know that I could say trade or sign that guy right now. I also think that this is the thing that's kind of, I don't know if it's bugging me, but like, how do you let Jerry DePoto handle this trade deadline if you haven't given him an extension? What are we doing? Either you believe in him and his vision and you want him to make deals that benefit this franchise, get them to the Super Bowl, to the World Series, or you don't. And if you don't, then what are you waiting for? Like, you can't let him deal with the trade deadline this year and the Mitch Haniger stuff. Like, there's really big decisions to be made. Do you deal Haniger? Do you sign him? Do you deal Marco? Those are real Kyle Seager. Like, there's a bunch of very real conversations that you have to have. And I'm not sure how he can realistically make those decisions without knowing what his long-term future is. What am I missing?
Don't you have to see the next 100 games?
Well,
don't you need to see J.P. Crawford and Evan White?
You don't have that time. You got to sign the guy, even if it's to a 2-year deal.
You got to make a decision. You have 30 days to make a decision.
Yeah, and I've been thinking about Hattie because I think it was you who was saying like maybe he wouldn't accept a short-term deal. I think he does. I think he has to. Like, ultimately, he hasn't had, like, what, are you going to walk away from a second job? Like, I don't know that there's another GM job out there for him if he walks away from this for years. Maybe eventually he works his way back into one. He can obviously do TV if that's where he wants to go. But there's only 30 of these jobs. I don't see him waltzing right into another one if he walks away from this. So I think the Mariners actually have a little bit of leverage in that conversation, at least enough for him to like say, yeah, if you're offering me a 2-year deal, I think I got to take it. I think they should do that. Yeah, all right, Brock, maybe you do need some more time to figure out exactly where this rebuild's going, but you can't have him be a lame duck going into the trade deadline. Like, it just doesn't make sense.
I mean, they said the same thing in Chicago about the Bears. You can't have these guys doing it. If you don't believe in their leadership, how can you have them put together a draft? How can you have them make this decision at quarterback? And they went about it, and I think had one of the best moves of the entire NFL draft, going up and getting Fields at 12 and everything else. And that's a staff, a head coach, and a GM that are under fire, that have to win, that are, you know, that there was that very much that same sentiment I remember heading into the NFL draft and all of that it led up to. How can you either fire him and bring people in to make that move, or you extend him and you believe in him, but ultimately, guess what he's got to do? He's got to go do his job.
Well, sure.
And ultimately, Jerry DePoto has got to go do his job, whether he wants to be in TV afterwards.
Yeah, but his job is very different depending on what direction you think. Do you have to win right now? Do you have to win next year? Are you trying to build this thing?
What is Mr. Stanton coming in? Those guys have lots of conversations. conversations. Lots and lots and lots. A very active owner, an owner that does want to win, an owner that listens
to Jerry a lot. You're not truly listening to him and valuing him because you haven't signed him. Like, what advice are you taking from him if you're John Stanton, if you haven't signed the guy to a deal? I know they got other things going on. They're looking for a president, but I just, as you head into a trade deadline where you've got some really big decisions to make about how close you actually are and what the best way to get there to close the gap to get into the playoffs, I think you need to decide whether or not Jerry DePoto's your guy or not. I think he is. I understand if you think he's not. I think that we talked about this. There's some arguments in the other direction, but make a decision.
No.
Because you got to go in one direction or the other.
I don't think the Mariners owners, I don't think they're ready to make a decision. No. I think that they're still gathering information, I think it's a dangerous thing to do.
Yeah.
When you look at the trades and the transactions they've made over the last 30 days, it's a bunch of back and forth. It's adding little guys here, getting rid of little guys here. It's selling guys, it's buying. It's like, it's churning. It's not decisive.
That's stuff on the edges. I don't think that's indicative of what they're looking at long term. They haven't made any major decisions on Mitch Haniger, Kyle Seager, Marco Gonzalez. Those are the three decisions that you're going to make that are going to dictate how far, how close you think you are. What you do with Axio Rio, whatever, like that doesn't, Rios, that doesn't matter.
Or how about that Pitbull? A PTP.
Yes.
And
blah, blah, but those are ways you got to finish off deals. I mean, like,
wrap up that big Rafael Montero trade.
That's Kyle's
good thing we got
guy.
Him.
Favorite guy over there. You know, he's been frustrating. There have been some pretty good developments, though, I think, in the last week or two for the Mariners. One is the emergence of Jake Fraley. Jake Fraley is Johnny Damon, man. It's crazy to me watching him. There's so much similarity there. Like, I know he's got a better arm than Damon, and he certainly hasn't done as much offensively in this league as Johnny Damon has, or even close to it, but he's got some of the same speed, hustle, the way he runs the bases, he gets on base the way Damon did, and there's just something about the way he drops the barrel of the bat to that low pitch, takes it out of the park, that is very, very Johnny Damon-like.
An incredible eye. What did I read? That he just set a Mariner record in the first 20 games of a season with 21 walks or something like that?
I think he has 30 walks in 20 games.
Pretty remarkable.
It's insane.
Control the zone.
Barry Bonds.
He does that. quite the power, necessarily. But, man, it's a pretty good development.
And your guy, Logan.
Well,
your guy that you were a little worried
about,
a little flat fastball, a little concerned about Logan Gilbert.
Let me get back to Logan in a second. On Fraley, I just want to say this because I think it's important. You got to give that guy a shot, right? Don't you have to reward production by giving it more opportunity?
Yes.
That's a Moneyball thing. It gets lost because Moneyball is always assumed to be just about on base percentage. But if you go back and remember the whole piece on Chad Bradford, the whole thing is reward productivity, that there's something to producing. And if this kid's doing it, I don't care that he doesn't have the pedigree of Kelnick or Trammell or somebody else. Like, you got to play him.
Yep.
You got to reward productivity and see where it goes, give him more opportunity. And Gilbert, yes, you're right, Brock. That's after a sketchy first few weeks. Really, really encouraging in his last couple starts.
Pretty good command, man. Yeah, in the first couple weeks, he left that flat fastball in the center of the plate a little bit, got damaged for it, felt some of the pains and the growing pains with it with big league guys that, even though their averages are not remarkable, you give them center cut stuff, you're asking for trouble, and his command since then has been pretty good.
Yeah, he stayed out of the middle of the plate.
Golly, he just is long.
He is long.
My little Titus has grown as a pitcher. I love watching him pitch. It's so fun now. They can throw a two-seamer and a four-seamer and actually pitch with a little bit of command every once in a while. And he doesn't throw it as hard as some of the kids in his league, but just his size. There's an intimidation factor when he strides to the plate because he's just big. And Logan, I remember, wasn't it Tito in his very first start that said, geez, you know, when that guy strides at you, that ball is halfway to you. And it makes difference why he's a first-round pick. And, yeah, that's been super encouraging.
But it also shows you, if you're in the middle of the plate with your fastball, it doesn't matter what your delivery looks like. Major league hitters are going to destroy you. And over the last week or two, last couple starts, he's hitting the corners, he's painting the black, he's got the off-speed pitches working with a lot more confidence and command. And then, you know, you're starting to see why he was picked where he is and why he's projected to be a top of the rotation kind of guy. So pretty exciting. I know that not everything has been positive, and Kyle, you're right in your Montero frustration of blowing the game Saturday.
It's a coin flip.
I know. But there are some positive things taking place under the surface, which I think are pretty relevant. So there you go, Brock. That's kind of where we're at today.
Poof. big week.
Yeah.
It'll be a big week for, I think, everybody in town for these Mariners. Going to get back to 500 every time they dip and they're three or four under. They kind of close the gap and they kind of keep you interested. And, yeah, we'll see exactly what the headlines are for the Seattle Seahawks when we chat next week.
Candlelight dinners. I can see it now. Pete and Russ under the star. It's going to be beautiful out starting tomorrow. Just some beautiful outdoor candlelight dining for Pete and Russ. All right, we'll be back with you guys next week. Until then, the hay
is in the barn.
See everybody.
This is the chopper!